So we're standing up, we're here, and whatever happens, we're not laying down again.
It didn't work. No.
Trust the system.
200,000 people that weren't even registered voted. 430,000 votes disappeared from President Trump's tally. And you can't stand there and tell me that it worked.
I don't want to say that what we're doing is right. But if the election is being stolen, what is it going to take?
Okay, so of an individual coughing a lot. Those are all specific claims being made by Trump and people around him. So that's the sort of broader context for yesterday's hearings. Let's now get into some of the specific claims. Every central claim about the 2020 election made by failed former President Donald Trump and the people around him, including people like Mark Meadows, but also wackier people like Sidney Powell, Mike Pillow Lindell, and others. Every single one of those claims was systematically contradicted and debunked by mostly Republican testimony, as we saw during yesterday's second day of the Trump riot hearings. I'm going to give you some examples here, and you will see how comprehensively every single one of these claims is easily refuted. Former Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt, a Republican, said there is no evidence of even 8 dead people voting, never mind the 8,000 dead voters that Trump and people around him claimed.
The claim that dead people were voting. In fact, Mr. Giuliani told Pennsylvania state legislators that 8,000 dead people voted in Pennsylvania. You investigated those claims of voter fraud. Can you tell us what you found?
Not only was there not evidence of 8,000 dead voters voting in Pennsylvania, there wasn't evidence of 8. We took seriously every case that was referred to us, no matter how fantastical, no matter how absurd, and took every one of those seriously, including these.
So it's not that they say, well, you have to investigate all of it. It was investigated. You just don't like the outcome of that investigation. And we've dead voters, that's one bucket of claims. We've looked into it extensively. There was an investigation, I believe it was in Michigan, where they started with a list of I believe it was 10,000 supposedly dead voters. I believe it was The Guardian, if not the BBC. They said, let's randomly choose, I think it was 35 of the 1,000 or 2,000, whatever. Let's investigate them. And then with those 35, they found most of them, there was evidence that the people were alive. Like, there was just really no reason to think that they were dead. In a few cases, it was people who were indeed alive at the time that they voted. And then when they mailed in their ballot, then they died. Nothing illegal there. In some cases, there was like junior, senior confusion. I mean, it was all just picked apart. Next claim, Georgia smuggled ballots. Former acting deputy attorney general testifies that he personally investigated the Georgia smuggled ballots, found nothing, told him it was false, but it didn't matter.
To play again a testimony from Mr. Donahue, who appeared before the committee before today.
Mr. Donahue, we talked at some length about whether or not the White House or the president was informed about the Antrim report. On the results of the investigations, the interviews that had gone on Fulton County, how would those results have been communicated to the White House, to the president?
I don't know how they were initially communicated. I do know that they came up in subsequent conversations with the president, and Dad Rose and I essentially told him, we looked into that, and it's just not true.
Okay, so he was informed.
I told the president myself that several times in several conversations, that these allegations about ballots being smuggled in a suitcase and run through the machine several times, it was not true. That we looked at the video, we interviewed the witnesses, it was not true.
Right.
We're doing a class action lawsuit against all machines.
So there is another claim, the idea of ballots smuggled in, and there were videos with ominous music of suitcases in different places with no reason whatsoever to believe that the suitcases contained fraudulent ballots. People have suitcases. It's not like a huge smoking gun in and of itself. And Trump was told, and yet he continued to repeat it. And then lastly, again, just as another example, we could do this all day, but I won't do it to you. The other claim was more votes than voters in Philadelphia. Philadelphia and Pennsylvania in general became a big focus because they stopped counting and then started again. Of course, if you understand the scheduling for vote counting in Philadelphia, you would know that they just have a schedule.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
For me, when I think of Juneteenth, part of what I think about is both the both-handedness of it. That it is this moment in which we mourn the fact that freedom was kept from hundreds of thousands of enslaved people for years and for months after it had been attained by them. And then at the same time, celebrating the end of one of the most egregious things that this country has ever done.
Today, a Democracy Now! Juneteenth special, a federal holiday commemorating the day in 1865 when enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, belatedly learned of their freedom more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. We'll speak to Clint Smith, author of How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. We'll also air a speech at the United Nations by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project.
It is time for the nations that engaged in and profited from the transatlantic slave trade to do what is right and what is just. It is time for them to make reparations to the descendants of chattel slavery in the Americas. This is our global truth. The truth we as human beings understand with stark clarity, there can be no atonement if there is no repair.
And then, as Harvard University reveals the school's extensive ties to slavery, we speak with MIT historian Craig Stephen Wilder, author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Special. On this, the newly created Juneteenth federal holiday, which marks the end of slavery in the United States. The Juneteenth commemoration dates back to the last days of the Civil War, when Union soldiers landed in Galveston, Texas, on June 19, 1865, with news that the war had ended, and enslaved people belatedly learned they were freed. It was 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. In 2021, President Biden signed legislation to make Juneteenth the first new federal holiday since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day was created nearly 40 years ago. On the day after Biden signed the legislation making Juneteenth a holiday, I spoke to the writer and poet Clint Smith, author of the book How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. I began by asking him about traveling to Galveston, Texas, and his feelings on Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday.
As you mentioned, I went to Galveston, Texas. I've been writing this book for 4 years, and I went 2 years ago, and it was marking the 40th anniversary of when Texas had made Juneteenth a state holiday, and it was the Al Edwards prayer breakfast. The late Al Edwards Sr. is the state legislator, a black state legislator, who made possible and advocated for the legislation that turned Juneteenth into a holiday, a state holiday in Texas. And so I went in part because I wanted to spend time with people who were the actual descendants of those who had been freed by General Gordon Granger's General Order Number 3. And it was a really remarkable moment because I was in this place on this island, on this land, with people for whom Juneteenth was not an abstraction. It was not a performance. It was not merely a symbol. It was it was part of their tradition. It was part of their lineage. It was an heirloom that had been passed down that had made their lives possible. And so I think I gained a more intimate sense of what that holiday meant. And to sort of broaden out more generally, you spoke to how it was more than 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, and it was an additional 2 months after General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox, effectively ending the Civil War. So it wasn't only 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, it was an additional 2 months after the Civil War was effectively over. And so for me, when I think of Juneteenth, part of what I think about is both the both-endedness of it, that it is this moment in which we mourn the fact that freedom was kept from hundreds of thousands of enslaved people for years and for months after it had been attained by them. And then at the same time, celebrating the end of one of the most egregious things that this country has ever done. And I think what we're experiencing right now is a sort of marathon of cognitive dissonance in the way that is reflective of the Black experience as a whole, because we are in a moment where we have the first new federal holiday in over 40 years, and a moment that is important to celebrate the Juneteenth and to celebrate the end of slavery, and to have it recognized as a national holiday. And at the same time that that is happening, we have a state-sanctioned effort across state legislatures across the country that is attempting to prevent teachers from teaching the very thing that helps young people understand the context from which Juneteenth emerges. And so I think that we recognize that as a symbol, Juneteenth is not that it matters, that it is important, but it is clearly not enough. And I think what the fact that Juneteenth has happened is reflective of a shift in our public consciousness, but also of the work that Black Texans and Black people across this country have done for decades to make this moment possible.
And can you explain more what happened in Galveston in 1865, and even, as you point out, what the Emancipation Proclamation actually did 2.5 years before?
Right. So the Emancipation Proclamation is often a widely misunderstood document. So it did not sort of wholesale free the enslaved people throughout the Union. It did not free enslaved people in the Union. In fact, there were several border states that were part of the Union that continued to keep their enslaved laborers, states like Kentucky, states like Delaware, states like Missouri. And what it did was it was a military edict that was attempting to free enslaved people in Confederate territory. But the only way that that edict would be enforced is if Union soldiers went and took that territory. And so part of what many enslavers realized, right, and realized correctly, was that Texas would be one of the last frontiers that Union soldiers would be able to come in and enforce the Emancipation Proclamation, if they ever made it there in the first place, because this was 2 years prior to the end of the Civil War. And so you had enslavers from Virginia and from North Carolina and from all of these states in the Upper South who brought their enslaved laborers and relocated to Texas in ways that increased the population of enslaved people in Texas by the tens of thousands. And so when Gordon Granger comes to Texas, he is making clear and letting people know that the Emancipation Proclamation had been enacted in ways that, because of the topography of Texas and because of how spread out and rural and far apart from different ecosystems of information many people were, a lot of enslaved people didn't know that the Emancipation Proclamation had happened. And some didn't even know that General Lee had surrendered at Appomattox 2 months prior. And so part of what this is doing is making clear to the 250,000 enslaved people in Texas that they had actually been granted freedom 2.5 years prior, and that the war that this was all fought over had ended 2 months before.
During the ceremony making Juneteenth a federal holiday, President Biden got down on his knee to greet Opal Lee, the 94-year-old activist known as the grandmother of Juneteenth. This is Biden speaking about Lee.
As a child growing up in Texas, she and her family would celebrate Juneteenth. And Juneteenth, 1939, when she was 12 years old, a white mob torched her family home. But such hate never stopped her any more than it stopped the vast majority of you I'm looking at from this podium. Over the course of decades, she's made it her mission to see that this day came. It was almost a singular mission. She's walked for miles and miles, literally and figuratively, to bring attention to Juneteenth, to make this day possible.
And this is Opal Lee speaking at Harvard School of Public Health.
I don't want people to think Juneteenth is just one day. There is too much educational components. We have too much to do. I even advocate that we do Juneteenth, that we celebrate freedom from the 19th of June to the 4th of July. Because we weren't free on the 4th of July, 1776. That would be celebrating freedom. You understand? If we were able to do that.
And that is Opal Lee, considered the grandmother of Juneteenth. And Clint, one of the things you do in your book is you introduce us to grassroots activists. This doesn't come from the top. This comes from years of organizing, as you point out, in Galveston itself and with people like, not that there's anyone like Opal Lee.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Part of what this book is doing, it is an attempt to uplift the stories of people who don't often get the attention that they deserve in how they shape the historical record. So that means the public historians who work at these historical sites and plantations. That means the museum curators. That means the activists and the organizers, people like Take 'Em Down NOLA in New Orleans, who pushed the city council and the mayor to make possible the fact that in 2017, these statues would come down, several Confederate statues in my hometown in New Orleans. And part of when I think about someone like Ms. Opal Lee, part of what I think about is our proximity to this period of history, right? Slavery existed for 250 years in this country and has only not existed for 150. And, you know, the way that I was taught about slavery growing up in elementary school, we were made to feel as if it was something that happened in the Jurassic Age, that it was the Flintstones, the dinosaurs, and slavery, almost as if they all happened at the same time. But the woman who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture alongside the Obama family in 2016 was the daughter of an enslaved person, not the granddaughter or the great-granddaughter or the great-great-granddaughter, the daughter of an enslaved person is who opened this museum, the Smithsonian, in 2016. And so there's clearly, for so many people, there are people who are alive today who were raised by, who knew, who were in community with, who loved, people who were born into intergenerational chattel bondage. And so this history that we tell ourselves was a long time ago wasn't in fact that long ago at all. And part of what so many activists and grassroots public historians and organizers across this country recognize is that if we don't fully understand and account for this history that actually wasn't that long ago, that in the scope of human history was only just yesterday, then we won't fully understand how our contemporary landscape of inequality today. We won't understand how slavery shaped the political, economic, and social infrastructure of this country. And when you have a more acute understanding of how slavery shaped the infrastructure of this country, then you're able to more effectively look around you and see how the reason one community looks one way and another community looks another way is not because of the people in those communities, but is it because of what has been done to those communities generation after generation after generation. And I think that is central to the sort of public pedagogy that so many of these activists and organizers who have been attempting to make Juneteenth a holiday and bring attention to it as an entry point to think more wholly and honestly about the legacy of slavery have been doing.
During an interview on CNN, Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called out the 14 Republican Congress members, all white men, who voted against making Juneteenth a federal holiday.
This is pretty consistent with, I think, the Republican base, and it's whether it's trying to fight against teaching basic history around racism and the role of racism in U.S. history to, you know, there's a direct through line from that to denying Juneteenth, the day that is widely recognized and celebrated as the symbolic kind of day that to represent the end of slavery in the United States.
If you could respond to that, Clint Smith, and also the fact that on the same day yesterday, the Senate Minority Leader said they would not be supporting the For the People Act, the Voting Rights Act.
Absolutely. I think very clearly the critical race theory, the idea of it is being used as a boogeyman, and it is being misrepresented and distorted by people who don't even know what critical race theory is, right? So we should be clear that the thing that people are calling critical race theory is just, that is the language that they are using to talk about the idea of teaching any sort of history that rejects the idea that America is a singularly exceptional place. and that we should not account for the history of harm that has been enacted to create opportunities and intergenerational wealth for millions of people that has come at the direct expense of millions and millions of other people across generations. And so what part of what is happening in these state legislatures across the country and with regard to the effort to push back against teaching of history, 1619 Project, critical race theory and the like, is a recognition that we have developed in this country a more sophisticated understanding, a more sophisticated framework, a more sophisticated public lexicon with which to understand how slavery, how racism was not just an interpersonal phenomenon. It was a historic one. It was a structural one. It was a systemic one. And I'm very much sympathetic. I know there's some sentiment out there that people are saying, well, you know, we didn't ask for Juneteenth to become a holiday. We want voting rights. We want police reform. We want abolition. We want, and I'm 100% understand that. I also think that we should not undervalue what it means for Juneteenth to become a holiday, in part because then we are not valuing the work that Black activists have done over the course of decades to get there. And because while symbols are not necessarily material change, they are not irrelevant. So I think all the time about having grown up in New Orleans, and to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard. To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Highway. That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy. That the street my parents live on today is named after somebody who owned 150 enslaved people. And the thing is that names and symbols and holidays like aren't just names and symbols and symbolism. What they are reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories shape the narratives that societies carry. And those narratives shape public policy, and public policy that shapes the material conditions of people's lives, which is not to say that taking down a statue of Robert E. Lee or making Juneteenth a holiday is going to erase the racial wealth gap. Of course not. But what it is part of an ecosystem of narratives and stories and ideas that can help us recalibrate our understanding of why certain communities look the way that they do and what needs to be done and invested in those communities to create a new set of opportunities. So we should recognize and celebrate that Juneteenth is a holiday. And we should also recognize that that is not enough. It is not nearly enough. And that it is one part of a much longer struggle and a much larger struggle to make sure that we are creating a more equitable and just world.
I want you to talk more about your book, How the Word is Passed, Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Can you talk about the journey you took? You were just mentioning where you grew up in Louisiana, the map of the streets of Louisiana, and why you feel it is so critical not only to look at the South, but your chapter on New York is something that people will be, many will be, shocked by. The level of, when people talk about the South and slavery, that New York, of course, had enslaved people.
It did. It was really important for me to include a chapter on New York City and a place in the North more broadly, in part because, you know, while the majority of places I visit are in the South, because the South is where slavery was saturated and where it was most intimately tied to the social and economic infrastructure of that society, it most certainly also existed in the North. What a lot of people don't know is that New York City, for an extended period of time, was the second largest slave port in the country after Charleston, South Carolina. That in 1860, on the brink of the Civil War, when South Carolina was about to secede from the Union after the election of Abraham Lincoln, that New York City's mayor, Fernando Wood, proposed that New York City should also secede from the Union alongside the southern states because New York's financial, political, and political infrastructure were so deeply entangled and tied to the slaveocracy of the South. Also that the Statue of Liberty was originally conceived by Edouard de Laboulaye, a French abolitionist who conceived of the idea of the Statue of Liberty and giving it to the United States as a gift, that it was originally conceived as an idea to celebrate the end of the Civil War and to celebrate abolition. But over time, that meaning has been, even through the conception of the statue, right? The original conception of the statue actually had Lady Liberty breaking shackles, like a pair of broken shackles on her wrists to symbolize the end of slavery. And over time, it became very clear that that would not have the sort of wide stream or wide mainstream support of people across the country. Obviously, this having been just not too long after the end of the Civil War, so there were still a lot of fresh wounds. And so they shifted the meaning of the statue to be more about a sort of inclusivity, more about the American experience, the American project, the American promise, the promise of democracy, and sort of obfuscated the original meaning to the point where even the design changed. And so they replaced the shackles with a tablet and the torch, and then put the shackles very subtly sort of underneath her robe. And you can but the only way you can see them, these broken chains, these broken links, are from a helicopter or from an airplane. And in many ways, I think that that is a microcosm for how we hide the story of slavery across this country, that these chain links are hidden out of sight, out of view of most people, from on under the robe of Lady Liberty, and how the story of slavery across this country is very, as we see now, very intentionally trying to be hidden and kept from so many people, so that we have a fundamentally inconsistent understanding of the way that slavery shaped our contemporary society today.
In your book, you write that by the early 19th century, the New York financial industry became even more deeply entrenched in chattel slavery. Money from New York bankers went on to finance every facet of the slave trade. Explain.
It did. So the banks in New York City were where the planters and the enslavers in the South got their capital. It is how they used the bodies of enslaved people as collateral for loans that they would take out and with insurance companies. I mean, and so it is very clear not only that New York City had enslaved people itself, right, for an extended period of time, as did places in New England, Connecticut, Rhode Island, but that it is the financial and economic infrastructure of New York City and the people who created mass amounts of wealth in that city that allowed slavery to continue to evolve and prosper. And that really made it so that there, I think we tend to have this sort of bifurcated view and overly simplistic view of like, oh, the people in the North were the good guys and people in the South were the bad guys. There were a lot of people in the North, and as I talked about, in New York City, who were deeply committed to the perpetuation and existence of slavery in the South because it was beneficial for them economically, it was beneficial for them politically, it was beneficial for them socially, and it was in line with how they understood the role of enslaved people and Black people in this country. It is not, they might not want to have wanted to have owned enslaved people themselves, but they most certainly did not believe in an abolition, or they most certainly did not think that they wanted something to prevent the massive influx of capital that they were receiving from continuing to flow into their hands.
Clint, before we end, you are an author, you're a writer, you're a teacher, and you are a poet. Can you share a poem with us?
I'd be happy to. And so when you're a poet writing nonfiction, that very much animates the way that I approach the text. And so this is this is an adaptation or an excerpt from the end of one of my chapters that originally began as a poem that I wrote when I was trying to think about some of these issues that I brought up. Growing up, the iconography of the Confederacy was an ever-present fixture of my daily life. Every day on the way to school, I passed a statue of P.G.T. Beauregard riding on horseback, his Confederate uniform slung over his shoulder, and his military cap pulled far down over his eyes. As a child, I did not know who P.G.T. Beauregard was. I did not know he was the man who ordered the first attack that opened the Civil War. I did not know he was one of the architects who designed the Confederate battle flag. I did not know he led an army predicated on maintaining the institution of slavery. What I knew is that he looked like so many of the other statues that ornamented the edges of this city, these copper garlands of a past that saw truth as something that should be buried underground and silenced by the soil. After the war, the sons and daughters of the Confederacy reshaped the contours of treason into something they could name as honorable. We called it the Lost Cause, and it crept its way into textbooks that attempted to cover up a crime that was still unfolding. They told us that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man, guilty of nothing but fighting for the state and the people that he loved, that the Southern flag was about heritage and remembering those slain fighting to preserve their way of life. But see, the thing about the Lost Cause is that it's only lost if you're not actually looking. The thing about heritage is that it's a word that also means I'm ignoring what we did to you. I was taught the Civil War wasn't about slavery, but I was never taught how the declarations of Confederate secession had the promise of human bondage carved into its stone. I was taught the war was about economics, but I was never taught that in 1860, the 4 million enslaved black people were worth more than every bank, factory, and railroad combined. I was taught that the Civil War was about states' rights, but I was never taught how the Fugitive Slave Act could care less about a border and spell Georgia and Massachusetts the exact same way. It's easy to look at a flag and call it heritage when you don't see the black bodies buried behind it. It's easy to look at a statue and call it history when you ignore the laws written in its wake. I come from a city abounding with statues of white men on pedestals and black children playing beneath them, where we played trumpets and trombones to drown out the Dixie song that still whistled in the wind. In New Orleans, there are over 100 schools, roads, and buildings named for Confederates and slaveholders. Every day, black children walk into buildings named after people who never wanted them to be there. Every time I would return home, I would drive on streets named for those who would have wanted me in chains. Go straight for 2 miles on Robert E. Lee, take a left on Jefferson Davis, make the first right on Claiborne. Translation, go straight for 2 miles on the general who slaughtered hundreds of black soldiers who were trying to surrender. Take a left on the president of the Confederacy who made the torture of black bodies the cornerstone of his new nation. Make the first right on the man who permitted the heads of rebelling slaves to be put on stakes and spread across the city in order to prevent the others from getting any ideas. What name is there for this sort of violence? What do you call it when the road you walk on is named for those who imagined you under a noose? What do you call it when the roof over your head is named after people who would have wanted the bricks to crush you?
Clint Smith, author of the book How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, speaking on Democracy Now! The day after Juneteenth became a federal holiday. Coming up, Nicole Hannah-Jones on the case for reparations. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our Juneteenth special broadcast, we turn now to Nicole Hannah-Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist who created the 1619 Project. In March, Nicole Hannah-Jones addressed the United Nations General Assembly as the UN marked the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade.
Good morning. It is my deepest honor to speak before you today on this day of international remembrance of the victims of the transatlantic slave trade. I have dedicated my life's work to excavating the modern legacy of transatlantic slavery, and so my thoughts are never far from what has become the defining subject of my journalism, and what I believe continues to be the defining undercurrent of life in the Americas. The legacy of slavery. I stand before you, the great-great-grandchild of enslaved men and women born here in the United States of America, part of the millions who lived and died under the brutal, immoral, and inhumane system of chattel slavery that existed for the first 250 years of the land that would come to think of itself as the freest nation in the history of the world. We gather here to mark the global trade that took some 15 million beloved human beings across the Atlantic in the hulls of barbaric ships, the largest forced migration in the history of the world, one that would reshape the entire Atlantic world and transform the global economy. We must never forget the scale and the depth of the horrors that people of African descent suffered in the name of profit. Profit that enriched the European colonial powers and built the nascent economy of the United States. We must never forget how the systems of slavery collapsed only to be reborn in other models of violent and racist economic exploitation, such as what we benignly call Jim Crow in the United States, but what is more aptly called apartheid. But on this solemn day of remembrance, the looking back cannot be and should not be solely defined by African-descended people's enslavement. Just as defining, just as important to remembering the legacy of the transatlantic slavery are the stories of Black resistance that would, more than any other force, lead to slavery's collapse in our hemisphere. No people voluntarily submit to their enslavement. And by obscuring the role of Black resistance in our collective rememberings of the transatlantic slave trade, we continue to do the work of those who sought to justify slavery by stripping us of our collective humanity. People of African descent resisted their enslavement from the moment of their capture. They resisted on the long walk from the interior of Africa to the coast. They resisted in the castles before being dragged out to the waiting ships. They resisted so frequently on the water that slave ships had to be specially designed to try to prevent mutiny. The ocean became the final resting place of thousands of Africans who resisted by choosing a final swim with the ancestors over enslavement in a strange land. As we remember our brutal enslavement by people who believed themselves to be civilized, even as they tortured, abused, and murdered other human beings for profit, for sugar for their tea, for molasses for their rum, for cotton to wear, and for tobacco to smoke, we must remember most the fierce Black radical tradition of resistance that did not begin with anti-colonialism efforts on the continent or with civil rights movements in the United States and other places, but with, as the scholar Cedric Robinson argued, the Chimarrones of Mexico, who ran away to indigenous communities or formed their own fugitive communities known as Palenques. We must remember Yanga, who led a community of fugitive Africans and fought the Spaniards so fiercely that they won their status as a free Black settlement. We must remember Brazil's Quilombolas, including Palmares, a fugitive Black community that would endure for 90 years in the Portuguese colony that would import more Africans into slavery than anywhere else in the Atlantic world. We must remember the Maroons of British and French Guyana, Cuba, and the United States, and the Bush Negroes of Suriname, who fought against their oppressors for five decades as they were attempting to re-enslave them. We must remember the revolts of enslaved people in Jamaica in 1690, in New York City in 1712, Queen Nanny in 1720, the Stoner Rebellion in 1739, and Tacky's Rebellion in 1760. We must remember the successful uprising of enslaved people, the most successful uprising of enslaved people in the history of the world, the Haitian Revolution, where enslaved people rose up and defeated three mighty colonial empires, becoming the first nation in the Americas to abolish slavery and establishing the world's first free Black republic, an audacity that the Western world has punished Haiti for ever since. We must remember revolts in Barbados in 1816, the Baptist War in Jamaica in 1831, and Nat Turner's rebellion that same year in the United States, as Black people attempted to make manifest the words of Patrick Henry, the famed American revolutionary who proclaimed, "Give me liberty or give me death," even as he enslaved African human beings for profit. We must remember freedom fighters such as Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and Gabriel Prosser. We must remember that it was not merely the Enlightenment ideas, some reckoning amongst white abolitionists, that brought the end to the system that had enriched colonial powers, but that abolition was propelled by constant revolt that forced colonial powers to realize, as scholar Mary Reckford wrote, it would remain more expensive and dangerous to maintain the old system than to abolish it. Black people were actors in their own freedom. Obscuring and marginalizing stories of Black resistance serves to justify the hypocrisy of colonial Europe and the United States by insinuating that had slavery been so bad, surely African peoples would have fought harder against it. These are lies of omission that, in the absence of truth, warp our collective memory. Resistance, therefore, must be central to any remembrances of the transatlantic slave trade and must, therefore, be connected to the ongoing resistance movements in the fight for Black liberation across the globe. I stand here before you today, a recipient of that tradition of resistance. My father was born in a little shack in 1945 on a cotton plantation in Greenwood, Mississippi. He was born into a family of sharecroppers, the violently enforced system of labor exploitation that emerged at the end of slavery. He was born into a strictly apartheid state, one where Black people could not vote, could not use the public library, could not attend schools with white children, and were lynched for things such as starting a union, walking into a room where a white woman was alone, failing to get off of the sidewalk fast enough in deference to a white person, or the greatest crime of all in the American South, having the audacity to be a financially prosperous Black person. In Greenwood in the 1940s, life was so devastating that Black children could be put to the fields as early as the age of 3 to start carrying water to workers. So when my father was 2 years old, my grandmother, Arlena Paul, a Black woman sharecropper, packed a suitcase and loaded her two young children on a northbound train and escaped the apartheid of the American South. My grandmother had a fourth grade education, and she would spend the rest of her life as a domestic and a janitor. But that single act of resistance, leaving the racial caste system of the American South with nothing but the determination that her own children would not pick cotton like she had, like her parents had, like her enslaved grandparents before her had, set in motion the events that would lead me to stand before this distinguished body today, addressing this most esteemed convening representing all of the nations of the world. Hers was an act of resistance that mirrored those of millions of enslaved Black people who resisted every day in ways big and small. She, like our ancestors, resisted in order to plant the seed for freedoms and opportunities that she would never see for herself. And it is this history, this understanding, that leads me to argue that the defining story of the African diaspora in the Americas is not slavery, but our resistance to it, of people determined to be free in societies that did not believe they had a right to freedom. We must acknowledge this history, as the legacy of slavery can be seen all around us. Today, the descendants of slavery fight to resist their conditions in the societies that once enslaved them. They suffer the highest rates of poverty, the highest rates of incarceration, the highest rates of death, and the highest rates of violence. And the tradition of resistance continues in protests against police violence and inequality from Brazil to Cuba to the United States. But we, the people of the African diaspora, should not have to find ourselves still resisting. It is long past time for the European colonial powers, for the United States of America, to live up to their own professed ideas, to become the great and moral nations that they believe themselves to be. It is not enough to simply regret what was done in the past. They are obligated to repair it. As I stand before representatives of the countries that once enslaved African peoples and the peoples who were once enslaved, as we collectively remember this day, the way for me to honor those who toiled and died and fought is to say this clearly and without flinching. It is time for the nations that engaged in and profited from the transatlantic slave trade to do what is right and what is just. It is time for them to make reparations to the descendants of chattel slavery in the Americas. This is our global truth, the truth we as human beings understand with stark clarity. There can be no atonement if there is no repair. It is time, it is long past time, for reparations for the transatlantic slave trade and all the devastation that it has wrought and all the devastation that it continues to reap. I thank you very much for your attention as we all remember this crime against humanity together. Thank you.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist who created the 1619 Project. When we come back, we look at how Harvard University has revealed the school's extensive ties to slavery. We'll speak to MIT historian Craig Stephen Wilder, author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities.
Calling the lapso and weeping in the evening dew that might control the starry pole and fallen, fallen light renew.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our Juneteenth special, we turn now to look at Harvard University's legacy of slavery. The university recently pledged to spend $100 million to redress the school's deep ties to slavery. The move came after the school issued a 130-page report that revealed at least 41 prominent people connected to the school owned enslaved people. The report states, quote, "Enslaved men and women served Harvard presidents and professors and fed and cared for Harvard students. Moreover, throughout this period and well into the 19th century, the university and its donors benefited from extensive financial ties to slavery," unquote. This is an excerpt of a video accompanying the report released by Harvard.
The evidence of the legacy of slavery at Harvard is in the landscape. You can go to the old burial ground and you can see the headstones for two enslaved people. One of them, a girl named Cicely, was enslaved to William Brattle, who was a tutor, a treasurer, and a fellow at Harvard University.
We also know that several of Harvard's presidents who lived in Wadsworth House, which is still standing on campus today, owned enslaved people of African origins, among them Venus, Bilah, and Juba.
That's an excerpt from the video that accompanies the Harvard report. In this clip, Harvard fellow Christopher D.E. Willoughby tells the story of an African teenage boy who was later dissected and studied by a Harvard professor.
Stormon is a particularly tragic figure. He's only 17 years old. At the end of about 6 months to a year of being on display, he takes his own life. He hangs himself. But Stormon's tragedy doesn't end with his death. When Stormon kills himself, they give his body to Harvard.
Harvard faculty member Jeffries Wyman conducted a dissection of Stormon's body, and they also made a set of casts of his body that remained in the Harvard Peabody Museum collections.
His skeleton is turned into a teaching tool. They say it's left in the care, what irony, of Professor Louis Agassiz. Stormon is measured and put in a linear position anatomically between whites and great apes. So not only is his body being destroyed, he's also being turned into this point of data to prove his own inferiority.
That's an excerpt from the video made by Harvard University as part of a new report documenting the school's deep ties to slavery, Harvard and the legacy of slavery. For more, we turn to MIT history professor Craig Stephen Wilder, who's long followed this issue, the author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I recently interviewed Wilder. I began by asking him to talk about the significance of Harvard's findings.
I'm happy to be back, and I think it's been a long road. As you point out, it's been basically 20 years since Ruth Simmons became the president of Brown University back in 2003, and media attention turned to the public sort of secret of Brown's extensive ties to the slave trade. Ruth Simmons back then actually commissioned a report that was eventually published in 2006, the Slavery and Justice Report, that actually laid out Brown's extensive ties to slavery and the slave trade and came forward with recommendations. We now sit, as you say, you know, 19, 20 years later, and Harvard has come forward with this report. That's been a long journey, but the report actually documents an extraordinarily extensive, deep history between the university and slavery that begins at its founding in 1636. Almost immediately, Harvard had an enslaved African on its campus, a man who was simply referred to as the Moor and who was used to serve the students. That man likely arrived in Massachusetts on a ship named the Desire. It was the first ship, slave ship, to leave New England. It was carrying captive enslaved Pequot Indians into Bermuda and the West Indies, where they were sold for various goods, including Africans. And so really, Harvard's ties to slavery begin with the founding of the institution. And as the report lays out, Harvard depended upon slavery and the slave economy, both in New England, but also in the South and the West Indies, for virtually all of its history. Harvard's history with slavery goes well into the late 19th century. And I would add that after the after its ties to slavery end, and they end somewhat involuntarily, Harvard actually then goes to the work of erasing the story of slavery from its past. And so we're really only beginning to reconcile and to really struggle with the deep ties that this institution has to slavery.
Professor Wilder, in addition, of course, to this clear complicity between Harvard University and other elite universities to slavery, there was also the question in the report that was raised about Harvard faculty advancing theories of racial difference and eugenics. Could you talk a little bit about that?
You know, one of the sort of striking findings is that in the 19th century, as race science really comes to dominate the academy, it's the period when science really comes to take over and the modern university gets established. That part of its modernity is its claim to science, its claim to expertise, its claims to a kind of precision in academic research. And the way that that happens is the scientists really turn themselves over to the slave economy. They become, in fact, the chief defenders of slavery, but not just at Harvard, but at universities across the United States. Race science really sort of thrives. Louis Agassiz, who's mentioned in the beginning of your introduction to this, the Harvard race scientist, used enslaved people on a South Carolina plantation for his research. Enslaved people were actually used as research material on colleges and university campuses across the United States. At Dartmouth, you know, which has one of the oldest medical schools, one of the college physicians actually uses the body of an enslaved man. And much like Louis Agassiz, the description that you gave earlier, he takes the body of this enslaved man, Cato, and skins him. He tans the skin of this enslaved black man like leather and uses it to dress his instrument case. And then he takes the skeleton of the enslaved black man and strings it together for instructional purposes. The beginning of science at the American college and the American university is, in fact, a story of the violent consumption of living and deceased enslaved people.
Professor Wilder, as you pointed out earlier, the Brown University report appeared in 2006, but it was only in 2019 that the Harvard president said that such research should be conducted at Harvard. Why did it take so long? Like, what kind of pressure led to this?
You know, I always start with Ruth Simmons at Brown because I think as the first African-American woman, the first woman and the first person of color to head an Ivy League institution, she did a tremendous service in actually getting this story told. The Brown Report was a phenomenal document and a transformative moment in the history of higher education. What's sort of really quite sad is that in the aftermath of that report in 2006, Brown's peer institutions were largely silent on the question of their ties to slavery. In fact, most of these institutions simply pretended that this story was unique to Brown alone. And what happened in the intervening years is that undergraduate students, faculty, graduate students, staff, librarians, and archivists at universities and colleges across the United States began doing grassroots work on their institutional ties to slavery. They put up exhibits in libraries. Undergraduates did their senior theses on these topics. And that's what kept this story alive. You know, my sense is that what has really actually kept us focused on this is the research that thousands and thousands of people have done in courses. For instance, you know, the Harvard Project began as a course that got virtually no support, really no support at all, from the Harvard administration. Sven Becker taught that Harvard and slavery class for years. And the administration largely ignored what was happening in that classroom and didn't want to know what the findings were. That's also true of the courses that began at Columbia and at Princeton and at Williams College. And so really what's happened over the last decade or so is that students have really not just produced a lot of the research that we're now actually beginning to wrestle with, but student activism has actually forced institutions to deal with this history. And I would go back, you can go all the way back to the Occupy movement, to the more recent Black Lives Matters movements, and the decisions, for example, that Georgetown University students made in 2019, in fact, exactly 2 years ago, to tax themselves, to impose fees on themselves in order to begin to pay reparations to the enslaved people who were used to both build Georgetown and fund its first 50 years of existence, and then who were sold in 1838 from Maryland into Louisiana. And the profits from that sale were used to pay off the debts of the college. It was the undergraduates who actually restarted the reparations conversation. It was the undergraduates, it was student activism that brought us back to this moment.
I wanted to turn to the short film again that premiered along with the launch of the Harvard University report. In this clip, a Harvard professor describes how Harvard Law School was founded.
In 1736, Antigua's plantation owners became fearful that enslaved workers were plotting against them, and they decided to crack down.
The royal family was involved in putting down this slave uprising. A lot of head chopping, decapitations to make people as examples, burning people.
Then Isaac Royall Sr. migrated back to New England to his huge property, several hundred acres of land. He brought enslaved workers from the Caribbean to Medford to work. Eventually, Isaac Royall Jr. donates lands to Harvard University, which the university then sells and uses to endow the first professorship of law at Harvard University.
And some people take that as the founding of the Harvard Law School.
Craig Stephen Wilder, this is pretty powerful stuff. What we're talking about here, I mean, it is just a story that some have known in this country, but and it certainly goes further than Harvard. But the story of Harvard Law School and its connection to the Caribbean slave trade, if you can explain who the royal family are, and the fact you've got this endowed chair as well at Harvard Law School named for them?
Yeah. You know, the royal family is a family, as the film points out, that traces back to Antigua, an Antiguan plantation family in the 18th century. They removed to Medford, Massachusetts, just outside Cambridge and Boston. Later in the century, Isaac Royall Jr., actually on that farm, that small plantation, has some 60 enslaved people. And that's the family that eventually actually donates the land that helps to fund and begin the law professorship at Harvard. I would point out that this is the story, actually, of professional education broadly. Medical schools in the 18th century begin with the dissection and consumption of the bodies of enslaved Black people and often Native Americans. They begin the very first medical school in North America, which is now at the University of Pennsylvania, then was the College of Philadelphia, begins when the colonial legislature transfers the body of a Black person to the scientists so they can do a public dissection and show, in fact, the new medical arts, display them and display the necessity of them. Law schools actually at Harvard, at Yale, at Columbia have very similar origin stories. They're actually tied directly into slavery. And law students at Harvard and Yale and Columbia have actually been doing a lot of the research to expose their institutional ties to slavery.
The new Harvard report doesn't mention the university is facing a lawsuit from a descendant of two enslaved people named Renty and Delia, or Delia, who were forced to pose in a photograph by a Harvard professor in 1850. Tamara Lanier filed the lawsuit saying the university is unfairly profiting from their images. In response to the report, Lanier tweeted, "Stop gaslighting us, Harvard." She also tweeted, "If Harvard truly embraced the principles in their report, the Lanier versus Harvard lawsuit would not be necessary." We spoke to Tamara Lanier in 2019 about her lawsuit.
Last week, my attorneys and I filed a claim against Harvard. I'm asking for the return of my enslaved ancestors' images. And the complaint is more than just a complaint about images. It's a history lesson, and specifically it points to the exploitation of slaves and how universities like Harvard continue to profit.
If you can comment on what Tamara Lanier is calling for, and also the recommendations of the report, like working with historically black colleges and universities, Professor Wilder.
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the striking elements of the report is the acknowledgement of the length of Harvard's ties to slavery, which, again, I think you can find something very similar for most of our elite educational institutions. Harvard's ties to slavery begin really with its founding in 1636, but they continue after the end of slavery in Massachusetts, roughly 1783. They continue right up until the Civil War. What's striking is that even after the Civil War, Harvard continues to have ties to slavery, because slavery still exists in places like Cuba and Brazil, and universities are actively actually pursuing those unfree economies as sites for profiteering. One of the things I had written in my book is that in the 18th and 19th century, you could actually judge the value or the prominence of a university by its collection of human remains. Universities and colleges actively collected human beings and samples of human beings. It was part of the evolution of science, and particularly a part of the evolution of the race science that drove the scientific revolution. And so what's happening currently in this lawsuit also involves what the report lays out as the thousands of remains of human beings that are currently held in the Harvard museums. Thousands. Most of those remains are likely of Native Americans. They've identified, I believe, 15 that are enslaved Africans. One can again go by university and see the way in which actually the 19th century and 18th century legacy of race science continues to play out on our campuses. And we literally live with the bodies of enslaved people and the bodies of indigenous people who were consumed in the process of building our institutions, not just in the cemeteries, but also in the museums and the libraries. They're there. To come to the recommendations, I think the recommendations include a number of things, including actually building on the Georgetown example, establishing relationships to descendant communities, Native and African and of African descent, memorializing and continuing to do research on Harvard's ties to slavery and the legacy of slavery at Harvard, reaching out to historically black colleges and universities to establish educational partnerships. Creating a legacy of slavery fund, an endowment, the $100 million to fund all of these promises, and then promising some long-term institutional accountability on these questions.
MIT history professor Craig Stephen Wilder long followed the issue of slavery, author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And that does it for our Juneteenth special.
Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warnoff, Camille Baker, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlin, and Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with public intellectual Henry Giroux, who is a professor and author and one of the most important political theorists of our day.
Henry has a profound political analysis of the meaning of the January 6th House hearings. We talked to him about fascism and how to fight it.
In our Lawyers You'll Like series, we have a special place for attorney and professor Holly McGuigan.
Holly is a criminal defense attorney. You'll not just like her, you'll love her. And her storytelling, like every defense lawyer, is beyond belief.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Law and Disorder Radio was launched 18 years ago by four lawyers for the purpose of defending democracy and the rule of law. This was just after the United States attacked Iraq under the false pretense that Iraq harbored weapons of mass destruction. We have seen democracy and the rule of law consistently disintegrating. Starting perhaps 40 years ago under the Reagan administration, this disintegration has brought us to the crisis of today. A committee of the House of Representatives is actually holding televised hearings on the attempted coup d'etat by the last president, Donald Trump. At the first hearing, it was demonstrated that Trump planned to ignore the results of an election which he had lost by 7 million votes. The insurrection that he initiated was unsuccessful. The Capitol was attacked after Trump incited the insurrectionists, and Trump did nothing to stop it for over 3 hours. When Vice President Mike Pence refused to go along with Trump's scheme to overthrow the election results, Trump suggested that hanging Pence was a good idea. The insurrectionists had built a gallows on the grounds of the Capitol. What has brought us to this crucial point? We live in a country where inequality is increasing, where, as Bob Dylan wrote, money doesn't talk, it swears. Nearly half the population is poor or near poor. Neoliberalism, an extreme form of capitalism, has taken hold and hollowed out the country. Schools have been privatized, and there is no national health care system. Students are $1.7 trillion in debt, just as a result of attending college. The country's infrastructure is crumbling. There's no decent railroad service. There are mass shootings almost every day, and the U.S. government is spending $813 billion on war this year. The United States refuses to help negotiate a peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine. The twin threats of nuclear war and climate catastrophe hang over our heads. Things are dreadful. We've reached a point summarized by the great Italian revolutionary Antonio Gramsci, who was imprisoned by a fascist dictator. Gramsci famously wrote from his prison cell, quote, "The old world is dying, and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters," end quote. We speak today with public intellectual Henry Giroux. He's a professor at McMaster University in Canada and the author of some 60 books, including America on the Edge. Professor Henry Giroux, welcome to Law and Disorder. I should say welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. And Michael Henry is fine for me.
What was your initial reaction to the televised hearings on the January 6th insurrection?
My initial reactions were complicated because at one level, I think it does a number of things that are important. It examines the broader campaign to deny essentially what you might call the will of the people. It doesn't just focus on the insurrection. It focuses more specifically on what it calls a coup. I think it establishes an historical record in some way and points to the dangers of the fight.